Good evening and welcome to Wednesday's Late Debate. Joining us here in studio tonight, we have Pippa Hackett, Green Party Senator and Minister of State for Land Use and Biodiversity in the Department of Agriculture, Michael Fitzmaurice, Independent TD for Roscommon Galway, Fianna Fáil Senator Timmy Dooley, Environmental Commentator John Gibbons and Elaine Loughlin, Political Correspondent with the Irish Examiner. We want to hear from you, so do get in touch. Text us on 51551. Email us on latedebate@rte.ie. or tweet to @LateDebateRTE. Now, this evening was the Chief Medical Officer, Tony Holland's first press conference since his tumultuous return to the fray last weekend. His read of the developing situation with COVID was sobering, to say the least.
In respect of each of those key indicators that we considered on Sunday, we have seen further deterioration in each one of them over the course of recent days, and we are deeply concerned about changing path of this infection.
And yeah, that was Tony Holohan earlier this evening. We heard that there was over 1,400 new confirmed cases on the island of Ireland today, over 800 of them in Northern Ireland. Professor Philip Nolan predicting that if we down in the Republic continue on the track we're on, by November 7th, we could see in the region of 1,600 to 2,300 cases a day. If I can put you, Timmy, if Tony Holohan and Neffat thought we should go to level 5 on Sunday and things have deteriorated rapidly to the degree that he's even more concerned, deeply concerned, as he said today, where does that leave us?
Well, I think it's been very clear for all the information that has been put into the public domain over the last couple of days that we're in a very serious situation. And I think Neffat advised the government in a particular manner, and the government have taken a very serious set of measures and put a serious set of measures in place. Some commentary would nearly suggest that level 3 is just another notch on the belt. It puts a very significant burden on citizens across the state, and they have been given, we all have been given, a very stark warning.
But we're almost 3 weeks into level 3 in Dublin, and the rate of increase has slowed, yeah, but it hasn't moved the needle to where we need it to be.
Well, I think the rate, the reproduction rate is now down at 1, which is where you need it to be, and it needs to go
They're
below that throughout
about
the country.
1.2 for Dublin, 1.5 for the country.
I think it's 1.5. My understanding is that it's 1 in Dublin, but I stand open to correction on that. It has certainly reduced significantly. And I think it's very clear there's a very stark warning issued, and this is now in the hands of the Irish people and in all our hands to address. Putting it to level 5 and not getting public buy-in won't solve the problem either. I mean, restaurants are effectively closed, pubs are effectively closed. You know, the GAA has taken very significant action on the back of this, maybe further than level 3 requires them to. So I've certainly seen in the last 24 to 48 hours a marked difference in the way people are dealing with this. They're listening to what Tony Holohan is saying. They're recognising what the government is saying, which is effectively you have to try and maintain some level of economic activity too.
Just in relation to that, now we spent quite a long time discussing that in the studio tonight. I don't want to put a lot more time onto it tonight, but the development in that was Tony Holohan explained quite clearly this evening at his briefing that completely, not what we understood the case to be. He said that he spoke to the Minister for Health, Stephen Donnelly, both before and after Neffat met on Sunday. So the notion that was being put about that somehow this Neffat meeting was out of the blue, the Taoiseach didn't know about it, surely to God, Stephen Donnelly told the Taoiseach.
Yeah, I've heard Tony Holohan's side of it. I haven't spoken to Minister Donnelly, but my understanding is that, there was a conversation or information passed indicating that there were very serious numbers, an increase in the level of infection. But my understanding is that at no time was there a discussion around moving to level 5. Because I think it was, I know I was out for a walk on Sunday evening and I just got back as the 9 o'clock news was about to come on, and I saw the headline moving to level 5, and I was shocked, as I think virtually everybody else in the country was. So, to the best of my knowledge, that wasn't flagged. But in any event,
as you were responding to me there, I got handed a statement from the minister by our producer there. Minister Donnelly informed the Taoiseach on Saturday afternoon that an EFET meeting would be held on Sunday. So he knew on Saturday that that meeting was going to go ahead, arising out of concerns about escalating case numbers. The Minister for Health and CMO spoke before and after an EFET's meeting on Sunday. Before the meeting, they discussed the deteriorating epidemiological situation. And after the meeting, the Minister was informed for the first time that an EFET recommended a move to level 5. The Minister and Taoiseach communicated after both conversations between the Minister and CMO on Sunday. So, you know, they mightn't have known the number 5 word, might not have been, but I mean, it was quite clear that something serious was happening and some serious recommendations were coming down the track. So surely that whole song and dance that the government was bounced or was going to be bounced into doing something, that this came out of a bolt by the blue, from the blue. But, it's not an accurate portrayal of I've actually.
Well, I think it is, but with respect, there's only a matter of hours here between whenever that discussion, and I don't know when Stephen was Minister Donnelly was informed of the Taoiseach, but the bouncing was that, you know, this indication that we were in such a serious situation that we needed to get to level 5, that became public at 9 o'clock at night on a Sunday night. If the Taoiseach and the Minister
knew... Not according to Tony Holland, from anyone on the NPHET side, well, because as he said, that was not in keeping with their...
Whatever the case might be, the reality is that the Taoiseach, and we now see the Minister, were informed about this on Sunday evening. That was a very significant shift from 3 days earlier, when a letter was communicated from NPHET to the government that said, we don't need to move from level 2 to level 3 even. So
the situation deteriorated very rapidly in those days and it's continuing to deteriorate
rapidly
around the country.
To make a recommendation to go to level 5 is what we're talking about as being an effort to bounce the government into a position. We've moved on from that. The reality is that the government have met. As you well know, the government decided to take the advice but not to move to level 5. I think that's the right decision, quite frankly. I think when
you
take the advice from the...
The poll that came out yesterday saying 2/3 of people thought there should be actually more restrictions than we've had up to this point.
And that's
fine. I just wonder, is the government listening to lobbyists and people who rightly are very worried and concerned about their jobs and their businesses?
I should hope that...
But is there a silent majority out there who are actually very, very scared and nervous and want more restrictions? Because this is what this poll indicates.
There may well be, but I think it would be a sad day if the government were to govern based on opinion polls. Government have to take all the information that's available to them. They've got to look to maintaining a level of economic activity. We have a huge, enormous bill that has to be paid in relation to the cost of meeting the needs of people during the pandemic. And unless we have some kind of economic activity, we're not going to be able to pay for that. So the government's priority has been at all times to take the advice, ensure that to the greatest extent possible people's lives are protected, whilst at the same time retaining a level of economic activity that allows this country to function and to be able to function into the future.
Okay, let's talk about maintaining activity, because a lot of activity was delayed, to say the least, today, because it was the first day of Operation Fanacht. I'll bring you into this, Pippa. A lot of people very discommoded, very put out. We're talking about frontline workers being delayed getting to work, getting home from work. People talking about being delayed for medical appointments. Is it counterproductive to put guard the checkpoints out on the road when people are trying to get their kids to school, trying to get to work themselves? Surely it is just adding more stress into an already stressed situation.
I understand it is very, you know, stressful and it's putting people out. But unfortunately, it is necessary. And this happened, you will remember, back in the April, May time. Actually, I was busy. I was coming up to Dublin a couple of those times for the government formation talks, and I was stopped a couple of times heading home.
You were stopped, but you weren't delayed for an hour because it was very little traffic.
I know, but you were still delayed, and I agree the volume of traffic now is much greater. But look, I think
what's it achieving is what I'm wondering.
Presence. The Gardaí need to have a presence there, and people need to understand the seriousness of the situation, and it is incredibly serious.
But what people understand is that the Gardaí have no power to do anything except wave you on when you say you're going to work.
I think people respect the Gardaí, and if they are stopped, and if look, indeed, all those people going to about their proper daily business, going to the jobs they absolutely have to attend. Yes, it is putting them out. But maybe for the few people who were caught today, who shouldn't have been out on the roads, they might think twice tomorrow, and maybe, you know, there'll be less.
But sure, what happened to them? Nothing happened to anyone who was. You can't.
Well, I think the Gardaí, as far as I know, the Gardaí,
no,
back
I know,
in April, May, I think Gardaí were taking license numbers. Now, no, whether they're doing the same again,
was,
and if they're
there
caught,
was regulations in place, well, there was powers, the Gardaí had powers,
but look,
to turn people back in April, May. Those powers are no longer in place.
Well, the reality here is that we're not...
That should be re-examined if they are doing...
We're not
checks.
Going to be able to use the Gardaí to effectively force people to do something that they don't want to do. It has to be based on encouragement. And I listened to a superintendent on the television.
Can I just give you one text, Timmy? I'll just stop you there. And I do need to bring in the other guests as well. But just this text. Quick text to tell you about my Garda checkpoint experience this evening. I left Dublin Port at 18:45. I got to services at Infield at 21:05, a journey that normally takes 45 minutes. Traffic from three lanes filtered into one. Got to check to find that all Garda had gone home. Is this the way to treat a weary trucker now out of time, says Liam.
Now, that's very difficult for people who are involved in the trucking sector. But what the effort that has gone in today is to flag to people, if you don't have to go to work, if you can work from home, please do so. And I suspect there will be an awful lot more people tomorrow as a result of what has happened today who will alter their behaviour. Many won't be able to, and truckers won't be, and general logistics won't be, and frontline workers won't. But
so is that, what we're literally doing? We're literally trying to make it actually so difficult to get make your
but
way
the
to work.
The reality
you
is,
might
Katie,
actually,
with the greatest respect to everybody.
It just seems an extraordinary way to go about it.
What we have to do here is try and change people's behaviour insofar as we can. It's not about arresting people. It's not about locking people up. It's about a very definitive signal. I noticed for the last couple of days when they talked about moving from level 2 to level 3, someone said, but there's no enforcement. Where are the guards? What are you doing about it? So now when the guards show up to flag in a very public and in a very prominent way that they're asking people to change behaviour, we have people who are upset and annoyed about it. But the most important thing is we're talking
because
about it.
Not
conversations are being had. And in my view, the same has happened before. People will alter their behaviour.
OK, let me bring in John Gibbons, because you're somebody who's writing for many years now about trying to get people to alter their behaviour. Would you agree with Timmy's point there, John?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think there's no question we're in a very difficult situation with COVID, and we went to level 3 and nobody really I won't say they paid a blind bit of heed to it, but I've noticed traffic out and about has been back to where it was pre-COVID. Now, that begs the question, what exactly is level 3? And I think there was no Garda enforcement. I remember, as we all do, back in March and April, the guards were prominent and visible, and that had an impact on people's behaviour, there's no question. And when they disappeared from the streets, we switched to level 3, but nothing changed. And as a result, people went back about their business. That's human nature. So I'm afraid, one could argue that maybe 8 o'clock in the morning isn't a great time because people, for example, are trying to get kids to school and so on. But there's no question about it that there's a mixture of carrot and stick here, and the guards, the presence of the Gardaí on the roads makes a difference. We know that.
Yeah, I want to bring in Elaine Loughlin. Were you following those leaks from the Fianna Fáil parliamentary party this evening?
Yes, it seems like this a leak a minute out of the PP at this stage. But Katie, I just wanted to go back to what Timmy had to say there on the government's position regarding the CMO and Neffet's decision on Sunday. You know, it seems like he's just trying to plaster over what are very significant cracks now in the government's story or what they were trying to lead us to believe. The fact now that we know that the CMO contacted the health minister on a Saturday afternoon to tell him we're going to have a meeting tomorrow. He was given 24 hours notice for a start of a meeting that was happening on a Sunday. That's very unusual, even in COVID times, to call a meeting on Sunday. So questions and significant questions are being raised this evening by the opposition parties around this. You know, what exactly did Stephen Donnelly ask the CMO when he contacted him on Saturday? Again, what did he ask him on Sunday before he contacted him ahead of that meeting? That he didn't get out of Tony Holland, that perhaps he was thinking of going to level 5. You know, the onus on him as health minister is to try and find out as much facts and the concerns indeed of NPHET so he can relay them to government and to the Taoiseach. I don't know, what did he ask anything of the CMO? Did he just pick up the phone and say, that's fine, you're going ahead with your meeting, grand, so chat to you tomorrow? Because that's what it seems like now at this point in time.
Timmy?
Well, I wasn't party to any of the conversations, but the reality is, whatever happened or transpired between Saturday and Sunday, there was a cabinet meeting on Monday. And the cabinet meeting on Monday took the advice and moved quickly, because there was no cabinet meeting, as you know, scheduled until Tuesday. They brought that forward to Monday. They listened to the advice and they chose to bring in a higher level of restrictions than already existed. And but for me, that's it.
When you see those figures today, though, you know, if you've been following this and you see where the figures are going, you see those exponential graphs, curves that Philip Nolan produced. Yeah. I'm sure a lot of people have watched that press conference this evening and thought, is level 3 good enough? Maybe we're being too cautious.
No level is good enough unless people, i.e. the public, respond. So if the outcome or the effect of listening to Philip Nolan this evening was shock, great, because then more people will alter their behaviour. Level 3 is a very heavy level of restriction. It limits to the greatest extent possible what people are doing. The reality is that people haven't been doing that. So, but at the same time, the government moved really quickly to address the situation that happened or developed over the course of the weekend. Monday, the cabinet meeting, decision taken, and now the appeal is to people to alter your behaviour. The GAA, in fairness, have weighed in quickly. And I think, you know, they recognised that there was potential problems out there and they wanted to get that off the agenda. So it's now for all of us to work to ensure that we do limit to the greatest extent possible our contact with others, that we just do essentially, you know, we just do the essential stuff that we have to do and try to remain within our own ambit.
Okay, let's talk about more stuff that could be done. Let's have a quick listen to Minister of State Patrick Donovan speaking on Today with Clare Byrne.
When you see shopping trolleys be pushed out of supermarkets with nothing in it other than alcohol, you know that there's a problem. I'm not talking about the person going into a Sintra, taking home a bottle of wine in the evening. I'm not talking about that at all. But what I am talking about is that where you have obvious slabs of cans and numerous bottles being taken home, you know that that's not being taken home for an after-dinner aperitif. You know that that's being taken home for a house party.
Now, much mirth and amusement about the idea of having your aperitif after your dinner as opposed to your dinner in the middle of the day. But I'm told, and we're hearing from your parliamentary party meeting this evening, Timmy, that this was a hot topic. Robert Troy and I think Mark McSharry as well saying we need to look at this issue of off licences, and Robert Troy saying we need to close off licences for a number of weeks. Senator Mary Fitzpatrick saying people are entitled to a glass of wine after a day's work, saying that's not the way to go. Timmy, have you ever left an off licence with a slab of cans under your oxter, or would you be more an aperitif man?
Well, I'd be more a man to go to the pub and drink a pint if I got a chance, and I'd have a glass of wine maybe at home on occasion. But no, I mean, I know there are differing views out there. My personal view is that I think we need to be very careful here. We need to bring the Irish people with us. And I'm not so sure that prohibition has worked in any democracy that I'm aware of. I certainly don't think it would be possible to prevent people gaining access to it. Look at the other really sad side of it. There are people who have a dependency on alcohol. And I think if you were to remove their access to alcohol, you might have a bigger problem. I also think that there are people who are staying at home. Yeah, there's the odd one. You see, you can always pick somebody with the shopping trolley and the slabs. They're few and far between. And I think we got to appeal to their better nature to say now is the time to stop that, rather than taking the heavy hand and trying to prohibit access to alcohol, which for many during lockdown
is, though, do we have the clip of Tony Holohan, because he was asked about this this evening.
When you've had a glass of wine, or maybe a second glass, when you've had a pint, or maybe a second one, or more, it just gets harder to follow the kind of advice and to keep social distance. Alcohol is there's no question, but alcohol has played a very important part in helping to create the kind of social circumstances that this virus thrives on. This virus loves alcohol.
Pippa, this virus loves alcohol. There is no doubt, but it has played a big part in helping this virus thrive.
Quite possibly, but I mean, it's not a new occurrence now. The off licences were deemed essential outlets from the very start, which to people in my circles felt that that was a strange aspect, you know, when we were shutting down like farmers markets and allotments. I mean, I know that's a strange comparison to make, but off licences were given that status right from the off. And
should
people,
they have had that status?
Well, I mean, you have to wonder, you know, what the purpose was, because I mean, supermarkets were still open at that stage. So if you were, you know, wanting to buy alcohol, you could get it in your local Tesco or Dunnes or whatever anyway. So that it wasn't as if the off licence was the only place you could buy alcohol.
No, but obviously you're talking about off, if you were shutting down off licence, you'd have to shut down off licence sales in supermarkets.
Well, I would imagine so as well. But I mean, it was deemed an essential. Well, I mean, I think to shut it down now after, you know, 8 or 9 months would be, I don't think prohibition would work. And I think that would just, and I would agree with Timmy, I think it would just turn people away. And it's real, it's pretty draconian at this stage, you know. I mean, maybe that's something.
But surely this is the stage where we need to consider draconian action.
Well, absolutely. But again, we have to appeal to people's better nature, and they're going to have to try and engage fully with the restrictions that are in place. And if people are having house parties, you know, that they know that that is wrong and they shouldn't be doing that.
If some people are wondering why Michael Fitzpatrick has been, Fitzmaurice, I should say, as being uncharacteristically quiet, it's because he got delayed and he's just joined us. Just on that point, because I think it's going to become a big talking point in the coming days. Is it time to maybe not shut down off licences, but maybe limit their opening hours?
Well, the one thing I would always say is that a pub is more of a controlled area than an off-licence. Unfortunately, we've seen a certain amount of domestic violence. My own honest belief in it is that you could do without a drink for a while. It's not the end of the world if they were shut for a while. When we haven't done it at the beginning, it makes it more difficult. But I would always have stated that in a pub, at least someone knows whether someone is drunk or someone is violent or whatever, and you can handle it or you can get them out. But in a house, the Gardaí have no powers, really. There's a lot of domestic violence and the Gardaí don't have a lot of powers to go in and sort it out. And unfortunately, we have consequences from that.
So are you saying we should consider?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I think we should consider that. Yeah.
Actually closing off?
Well, restricting them, restricting hours anyhow, definitely.
John, would you have an opinion on that?
Well, interestingly, one country that did this pretty much from the offset was South Africa. And the reason that South Africa actually has gone dry was they have such an acute domestic violence problem that it was felt that a lockdown would make that problem a great deal worse. And they felt that the rocket fuel for domestic violence is alcohol. And when you added that to long-term confinement, that it was an explosive combination. So that was the draconian, if you like, but that was the response of the South African authorities. So they took a public health approach to it as a means of curbing domestic violence. Now, that they're particularly, their situation is not directly analogous to Ireland, but there certainly is an argument in that favour. I'm not completely...
I'm sorry to cut across you, but Liam Herrick has just tweeted that Timmy Dooley is talking a lot of sense about off-licences on Late Debate. The experience of prohibition in South Africa has been pretty disastrous.
Yeah, I guess different people have different takes on it. As I say, the authorities in South Africa made that decision because South Africa has, for all kinds of reasons, historical, political reasons, they have a very, very acute problem with domestic violence. And it was felt, as I say, to be a step that could be taken. But I'm not completely convinced by Michael's suggestion that the pub is a controlled environment. I remember my first venture out after the original lockdown was if you like, rescinded in Dublin. And to be honest with you, it actually frightened me. There was no controls in that pub. There were people roaring and shouting. And, you know, the people that I'd arranged to meet...
What kind of pubs do you be frequenting, John?
I know. Well, you'd think they'd be a nice part of Dublin, but I'm afraid not. Basically, I was really surprised and actually a bit alarmed and kind of, as they say in the ad, I made my excuses and left.
Right. Elaine, how seriously should we take this talk of you know, some sort of prohibition on off-licence sales.
Mm-hmm. Well, both the Taoiseach and the Tánaiste were actually asked about this today. The Taoiseach didn't give much away. He just said that the Cabinet hasn't discussed this yet or hasn't considered it. Tánaiste went a bit further. He accepted the point made by, obviously, his colleague in Fine Gael and Minister Patrick O'Donovan, said he had a point to make. He mentioned that, you know, alcohol is a social lubricant, that when people meet up, the virus spreads, similar to what Tony Holland had to say afterwards. But then he also said that perhaps if we limit the hours that off licences are opened, people will just go earlier to get their slab or their cans or whatever they want for the house party. Exactly. But just going back to some of the points there, that, you know, pubs are not a controlled environment, or some aren't anyway. A pub is a far more uncontrolled environment now than a house party is, or even a dinner party with 8 to 10 people in a room. We've no controls over that. So perhaps it might be a good idea to reopen the pubs, make sure that they're sticking by all the rules around social distancing and all the guidelines that have been put in place now, and close the off licences. Then you would have people in a hopefully safe environment out enjoying a few drinks together and socialising, but you might not have the after parties that we've seen in recent times.
Yeah, and I'm just looking at a couple of more texts we're getting in here on this. Katie, I've lived in dry countries where the COVID rate has increased because of social distancing issues and people continuing to mix. That's from Tom and Kerry. And Cormac says, if a shop can ration the amount of toilet paper, then temporary rules to limit the amount of alcohol being brought is needed, and possible limit to 2 or 3 bottles per person is not prohibition. That's, what about that?
What about what?
If you could put away your phone there, Timmy, for a minute. I said the idea of rationing, of asking off licences to limit the amount of alcohol they'll sell to individuals.
Yeah, I think that's not a bad idea, to try to limit to some extent. But look, people will find ways around that. I think it's better that we would appeal to people's better judgment and just try to work with them, set certain standards and appeal to them. And I think, you know, people now realise that house parties or any gatherings creates a better environment for the virus to spread. And I think,
but sure, we realised that last week and the week before and the week before. But yeah, but there was, I think, still a lot of house parties.
There was a lot of them around certain, whether it was communions, and I know they were cancelled in my own constituency, and it upset some people over the weekend. And I can understand they're upset. But the reality is, I think, you know, once the figures have gotten to the level, that has scared people. But the other thing that we need to be careful about is not just looking at those that have contracted the virus in recent days. Thankfully, the death rate is still exceptionally low and is in no way corresponding with the levels that were there before. The numbers in ICU are low. Yes, they're rising a little bit. And I think sometimes we put perhaps too much emphasis on those that have contracted rather than those for whom it's a serious event. Because, I mean, the strategy from the very start was never about zero COVID.
It's important to say, because this was an issue that was formed a chunk of that briefing this evening. And there was a warning, basically, not to imagine that the virus has become less lethal because of where we're at in terms of people in hospital and people in ICU. Those numbers are rising and will rise to correspond with the case numbers that are coming through. That's what we were told.
But I think there's been some very significant learnings by the public over the course of the time. People that have and were vulnerable and sadly passed away in the first phase, that same level of contraction by people who are vulnerable is not, you know, is much reduced. Because I think people who know they're vulnerable, people of a certain age cohort, are minding themselves a lot more. The wearing of masks is certainly assisting. There's certainly an exuberance amongst a younger population. And, you know, look, we all have children. We all know they've had a dreadful, dreadful time as well. And, you know, so there were some parties after the Leaving Cert. You know, it didn't look great. But, like, these people have been through a really tough time. So I can understand how things get out of control. I think what has happened over the course of the weekend, the very stern warnings, the very direct intervention of Tony Holohan, has probably helped to recalibrate things a little bit. Okay. Has kind of pressed the reset button. And I feel certainly over the last 24 hours that people who were starting to drift a little bit have now sort of perked their ears up again and are focused on trying to address this thing. And I think we got to work with people. I don't believe in the big stick approach.
Okay, okay. I'm going to take a break there, but stay with us because we want to talk about climate action and the crisis of the forestry and timber industry after these.
The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
Bit right.
And we were just talking there in the break, what delayed Michael is you were hanging on for that vote on the bill, the Dying with Dignity bill, and a surprise outcome of that.
Yeah, there was
vote.
There was actually a huge surprise because over the last few months you'd have heard Minister for Justice and the Minister for Health saying that they intended to bring an amendment to the bill that would basically kick it down the road for a year. It would be a special committee would be set up. You'd bring in experts from all sides.
Sort of like what was done with the repeal of the
eighth. And you'd be debating it. The vote took place and the government amendment, which was baffling. I was watching the votes tonight and they were going everywhere. The government amendment was defeated and then the bill to progress on to committee as per usual with the bill at
the
moment.
Pre-legislative
which
scrutiny committee.
You'd imagine the government were voting against, but the vote split again all over the place, in all sides, and it has gone through Gino Kinney's bill.
Wow, that is a turn up for the books. But of course, it was in Fianna Fáil and in Fine Gael across
free
the
vote,
House,
yeah.
It was a free vote. It was
and
a vote
unusually count. In the Greens, Pippa mightn't be aware of it, say for the amendment, it was like 8-4. And then in favour of the government, because ministers obviously has to vote
of
for the government amendment. And then when it came in that it was a free vote, it was 12-0 the other way.
All right. Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Well, we may well return to that tomorrow when we'll no doubt be hearing more about it. But I want to move on to what was the big set piece on the political agenda today: the long awaited climate bill. Obviously, very significant because now we can't be telling any more fairy stories about where we're going with our climate targets. We're now going to be tied to these targets, legally bound. On 5-year intervals. Will we though be tied? Because am I right in saying that there isn't anything in the legislation to hit out if a department misses its target? There's no implications for a department that misses its target under this legislation, is there?
Well, I mean, I suppose at the outset, I mean, this is something our country, to be honest, has been crying out for. We needed this direction. We needed this legislation to empower governments, our government and future governments, to make sure we hit our climate targets. And, you know, we have come from this laggard position, which we still are as of today, but hopefully this is, you know, marks a change in direction for that. I think, you know, it is time to start the sort of stop the talking and really start the walking. And you know, the bill itself, now it's in a draft format, you know, it will be subject to pre-legislative scrutiny. And look, I think it's a momentous day for our country. And I think, yeah, moving forward, we're on the right track. And, you know, I think the bill will absolutely, I mean, it's a piece of legislation that will enforce departments to you know, and sectors, I suppose. It's better to look at it on a sectoral basis.
Is there a few sort of get out of jail cards there built into it, though? Let's talk about emerging technology. We've all heard about that in relation to the Brexit border discussions. There's talk about offsets, negative emissions technology. Are we giving ourselves, are we building in a little bit of leeway for...
I don't think so. I think, you know, potentially there might be emerging technology. We're not saying we're going to wait until emerging technology to act. And you know, that's across the board. But I think because it's grouped now in 5-year budgeting plans, you know, we're really, that kicks off straight away, you know, and there's work to be done, and everyone has to pull together for this.
Michael, do you think it's a momentous day for the country?
I actually don't, for the simple reason one of the things that wasn't even included, I think the government over the last number of years, the previous government, not this one in fairness, had spoke about that we're getting rid of diesel and petrol cars in 2030. That can't be even put into the bill because the EU won't give them the go-ahead. You have to get a derogation for that. On top of that, it's a year down the road, really, before each department has to basically knuckle down and set its different targets. But in my opinion, you know, we're in a crisis at the moment with COVID. We have Brexit around the corner. We have to keep our eye on the ball in that and keep people working. You know, I believe the 7% target is nearly a fantasy, to be quite frank about it. I think it is going to be very hard to attain each year. And, you know, we talk about doing things in over five or six governments. The reality of it is Eamon Ryan might be gone in four years and someone else could be in, or Timmy might be minister.
But isn't that the point? The legislation will be in place. A legal obligation.
Yeah, but like, look at legislation can be changed and let no one be caught in themselves. You can put amendments to legislation. So you can have your dreams of what you'll do. I think the first thing we need to do in this country, and in fairness to Eamon Ryan, and I spoke to him a few times on this, for 4 years with the previous government, I was hammering at the door that 6%, and Pippa would be well aware of this, round the country, every tree that you look at, other than forestry, wasn't included in our mitigation. So we weren't doing up the figures that could mitigate forests. And finally, we are now going to include that, which is a good thing. On top of that, we have no technology or no research done like the likes of Mittlener done in America in relation to what grain sequesters, what grass sequesters. Because at the end of the day, what we are always, what everyone is harping on about and beating the agricultural sector up, that cows put up so much and cattle put up so much and everything puts up so much, but we don't have the figures of what we're sequestering. On top of that, the part of the country that will be the solution, rural Ireland is going to be a lot of the solution to a lot of the climate targets that they're on about, and you have to work with people on that. At the end of the day, the person in Dublin that goes out, they have a sewerage going into their house. What is that putting up in the amount of carbon where it's going in and has to be treated? The water that comes in, the whole scenario of someone living in a city as against someone in the country. And we're going to this month in to the people that are struggling in a lot of areas and don't have public transport. We're going to throw a carbon tax on them, and we're going to do that for the next 10 years. We talk about the new world that we're going to be in, and we have to make things affordable. Our ESB bill and our PSO levy, €54 last week. So on one hand, we're talking about this world that we're going to go into and resolve things, and we're going to take more money out of people's pockets at the moment. Gas is going to run out in time. We are now like the birds within the nest with our beaks open, waiting for the worm to be dropped into us, because at the end of the day, 2027, the gas is gone. We'll be relying on Russia, so will Europe, to supply it. If the wind don't blow, and actually at the moment in the line of solar panels, we're talking about stuff we're going to do. Solar panel farms have not, the first one was only announced this week, and we have a long way to go.
Okay. John Gibbons, I'm sure you have plenty to say about that.
Yeah, I sure do. I always like to find something in common, and Michael used the word emergency there, and he's right, but I think he's looking at the wrong emergency. Brexit was an emergency. It continues to be an emergency. COVID is an emergency. It will continue to be an emergency. But all of these are completely put in the halfpenny place by the climate emergency. Now, unfortunately, some people don't accept that and have basically worked hard over the last 10 years and more, as long as I'm at it and longer, to spread doubt, confusion, misinformation, and basically saying, oh, we can't do this, we can't do that, you'll ruin rural Ireland, you'll do this, that and the other. And it's a shame, because we've lost a decade and more in time that we could have been solving this problem, that we could have been getting Ireland climate ready. Now, you take, say, our targets, our EU targets from 2005 to 2020, we were given a very easy target, much easier, say, for example, than some other countries. We were just told we need to get our emissions down by 20% in that period. Now, Ireland Incorporated, in that period, managed approximately, at best, 1%. Some sectors like agriculture actually went up by 8% since 2012. So we have a situation where we're given these targets, we're told we have to do them, and people say, ah, sure, that's not really real. That's not real Ireland. There, you know, and this notion, this very insidious idea that climate is something being imposed on us by people from Dublin or people from Europe, people who don't really understand Ireland, is just so unfortunate. Because, I mean, for example, last month, September 2020, was the hottest September ever recorded on the instrumental record in 140 years. Now, the second hottest September ever recorded in 140 years was September 2019. 4 million acres of California are in flames. The Arctic is at its second lowest ever ice. We've got massive wildfires across Siberia and into the Arctic Circle. We are in a global climate emergency. We've got to get our head around that and stop. I think Michael said we've got to keep our eye on the ball. You're absolutely right. That is the ball. We keep getting distracted by the small stuff, but we either deal with climate, we get our heads around it, we get our politics aligned with reality.
But to be fair, John, to be fair, like COVID, the COVID crisis is hardly small stuff.
It's not small stuff, Katie, but where did COVID come from, right? COVID, we know now COVID is a zoonotic disease, meaning that it jumped from wild animals into humans. Why did it jump from wild animals? What science has been able to tell us is that human impacts and deforestation and taking away the habitats of wild animals is forcing the viruses that they live in to find a new host. And guess who that is? That's us. We can expect more zoonotic diseases over the next 5, 10, 15 years. So,
well,
again,
not if Pippa Hackett has anything to do with it as our Minister for Biodiversity.
Can I just come in on one thing there? We have the EU today passed, the European MEPs passed, they had a vote today on climate and they're going for 55 or 60% or something. This is the same EU, John, that has signed up to the Mercosur deal, where there's forest being burdened down day by day to increase agricultural production, to bring meat from one part of the world over across to the other. And this is the madness that's going on. And then someone in the west of Ireland that has a few cows is being hammered.
I agree with you, Michael. And as you well know, what is also coming from Mercosur countries, last year, for example, we imported between 4 and 5 million tons of soya from the same deforested South American country. So if you're concerned about cutting down forests and the effect it has, well, the problem is livestock farming. It isn't just the cattle, it's what we have to feed them.
Okay, John, I want to put that to Pippa, because you're a farmer yourself, Pippa. We all know agriculture is responsible for over a third of our greenhouse gas emissions, and that puts us 24% over the EU average. I just want to have a quick listen to the IFA president, Tim Cullinan, who was on Drive Time, speaking to Sarah on Drive Time this evening.
There is no danger to the national herd here. So we want to work with the government to ensure that we can maintain a stable and a growing herd here in Ireland. That is very, very
stable
important.
And growing? You expect to increase the herd?
Well, we definitely want to maintain what we have. And if we can prove that what we're doing is decreasing the emissions from agriculture, well, then we should be able to increase the herd, yes?
Pippa Hackett, should we be able to increase the herd, the national herd?
Look, I think when you look at the situation at the moment for the last number of years, agricultural emissions have been going up. End of story. You know, it's nigh on impossible to decouple increasing emissions from cattle numbers. So I think to indicate, I think as Tim Cullinan has, that we know he's eager to continue to increase the herd. I just think it's physically mathematically impossible to reduce emissions while increasing the herd.
But yet this bill put a special category.
Well, absolutely,
which is a special category for the methane that comes from cows.
I agree, and that
which means that they're not expected.
No,
to
it doesn't.
That
no, they
the
are
way.
Expected. Biogenic methane. Methane must reduce. Absolutely, must reduce. I mean, you'll never get methane to zero. You know, from an emission point of view, but you absolutely must reduce it, and that's absolutely a given. That is accepted by the government. That is what we have to achieve. And
it's been characterised as not as big an issue as other greenhouse gases.
It only because of its short-term nature, but it is a very potent gas when it is in the atmosphere, and that's the problem. And because it's short-term, that's why it has been given that slightly special characteristic, but it must come down. It cannot continue to rise. It must reduce.
And is the only way to reduce that is to have less cattle.
Well, there are other there are other ways of doing it, and look, that would be the easy way. We could just, you know, slash off a whole couple of hundred thousand cows off the whole herd, and that, you know, that would give us an instant effect. But, you know, ultimately, there are better ways, and I believe there are better ways of doing that by a whole change to the farming system. How we do farming here needs to change.
But will that really produce the kind of emission slashing that we need to bring that sector into line?
Well, I believe it can. I mean, even if you look
so
at...
So you're saying can hang on to the herds that we have?
No, I'm not saying they can hang on, but they certainly mustn't increase the herd size, because that absolutely...
We're okay with the herd size as it is?
Not necessarily either, but unless we change the farming systems we use, if we don't start farming in a different way, in a way that is essentially working with nature, and that we're not doing that at the moment, and changing the farming system. So we essentially farm in a different way. We will have more diversification. Instead of growing more grass, we'll be looking at growing better grass that's good. And the thing about agriculture, and John mentioned it as well, I mean, no other sector like energy or transport, they can deliver, yes, they can deliver emissions reductions, but they can do nothing for biodiversity. They can do very little for other elements of environmental impact, whereas agriculture has to deliver for biodiversity and climate action. And in that, I believe, lies the strength. I think if we get the biodiversity piece right, we will certainly be delivering masses on climate action. And that is where that is a strength for the agricultural sector.
Timmy, do your constituents have an issue with the fact that you have now gone into government with the Green Party? And are they concerned about what that might mean for them? I'm talking about your rural constituents.
Rural base. I come from a small farm in the west of Ireland, so I full well know the implications that are here. But, I mean, farmers that I know recognise there's a problem. They've recognised it for some time. They've seen the difficulty in the change in weather patterns and what it's doing to their work. We've only a couple of years ago that we saw the fodder crisis because of the dreadful summer and a different kind of winter. They see the encroachment onto the land. They see flooding. So they know they're doing this a long time, and they know they have to change, but they want guidance and help and leadership.
And they don't want to have to reduce their herd numbers if they're...
It's not all about... It's better land use management. It's looking at anaerobic digestion. It's about farming much smarter. It's not... You see, I know it's a kind of a headline. Will we reduce the herd? Won't we reduce the herd? That sets rural against urban. It's not about that, actually. It's about looking at the totality of the farming enterprises. Farmers are trying to make a living. They're trying to raise their kids. They're trying to educate them. And they want to continue in an enterprise. But they recognise that the system is now broken. It's broken because of the impact on the environment and the implications that's having on their farming practices. But they can't do it on an individual basis. There has to be leadership. There has to be support.
But we've had a national policy transitioning here. But can I put you? We've had a national policy which was developed with a lot of expertise that were put onto a panel. And it got us, Food 2020?
Harvest 2020.
Food Wise 2020. That was demanding massive increases in output.
It was of its time.
It was only the other day. I also come from a constituency where, as far as I know, it's still national policy.
I come from a constituency where, you know, there was a coal burning plant built at Moneypoint, and that's now tapering out, and it served its time, and by 2025 it'll be closed. And now we have to look collectively as a government about the opportunity to capture wind out into the Atlantic Ocean that will still generate electricity but will retain people in West Clare and give them jobs as part of a new electricity generating enterprise. And the same things have to happen in farming in terms of setting the standards, working with farming and science, and putting the kind of financial supports that are necessary to do that transition. Because it's not about a cliff edge. It's not about changing to something different tomorrow.
Okay, I just want, I really want to have a few minutes on the forestry funding issue behind that transition.
The first thing is, Katie, I think that where Timmy is from and where I'm from myself, a lot of the farms are actually, in my opinion, doing no harm to the environment, because they're small farms in average land, with a cow maybe having 2 or 3 acres. But the big wins that could have been achieved, and I looked at the programme for government and I brought this up to Pippa before, the likes of the feedlots, the likes of the derogation that's given the real intensive people more room to expand. And that's coming from a farming person. And there's nothing there to stop that. So let's not be telling the fella or the woman down the country with the 5 or 10 cows, well, you better be cutting back, when there's someone here on a derogation that's able to work away and do what they want. Like, it's just pure hypocrisy where we're at.
Okay, I just in the last few minutes, I want to bring in the issue of the forestry, because this is an industry, this is the timber industry, responsible for 12,000 jobs. People are talking about chaos in this industry right now, a log jam in this process to grant licences for tree felling. Has reached a level where sawmills are running out of material, builders, providers are running short of timber, and that, of course, threatens all other sectors. Pippa, what's going on and what are you doing to sort it?
Well, look, this is a problem I essentially inherited with my ministerial role. But listen, last week and over the last couple of weeks, we brought legislation through the Shannon and the Dáil. It was passed last week overwhelmingly in the Dáil. And the legislation seeks to amend seeks really to make the Forestry Appeals Committee much more effective in how it works. And the problem is, there was a build-up in appeals. So licences are issued by the Department of Agriculture, and anyone can submit an appeal based on the licence issued, and that became blockaded.
That's it. Anyone who wants to fell trees or to plant trees needs a licence from the department.
You need a licence to plant and to fell, yeah.
And the general public can appeal that,
yeah.
And that has to go through a process.
Absolutely,
then, like
yeah.
A planning.
It's like on Bor Planola for forestry.
But the difficulty is, these appeals have been building up,
yeah.
And the backlog of these has been building up and building up to the degree now that there are hundreds and hundreds stuck in the system.
500, yeah.
And there is a huge number of people who can't cut down trees or can't plant trees, and the whole thing is grinding to a halt.
Absolutely, and that's what the legislation last week has sought to help to free up that backlog in the appeal system.
By doing what?
Well, it essentially allows the appeals committee to subdivide into you know, many subgroups.
They can hear more appeals.
Hear more at one time,
one
yes.
Time.
It also allows the committee to decide whether to listen to an appeal orally or you know, just from on a paper version. There are a number of elements to make that process more efficient.
Okay, Michael. Is this going to sort it out?
I hope it does, but I don't think it will. It will help in the appeals. That's the first thing. But the only thing, we have to go back a step. Since 2010 to 2020, the forestry has been going backwards. Or the government, and you've talked about climate change and you've talked about targets. From 16 to 20, 57% of our targets, and to what, and Pippa wasn't there at the time, 57% of what we said we'd plant is all we have planted. There's a department, in my opinion, in chaos. And what has happened is, with the likes of the Habitats Directive, there is things that we have to do different. And unfortunately, what we have done, we have kept giving the application to the same drummer, but the drummer anymore isn't qualified to get it through. And what has happened is, everything has been screened in. They haven't the qualification to screen it out. And unless we start at the beginning and make sure we change the whole procedure, we are in trouble. The other thing, there is a report on your desk, Pippa, and I am wondering, in the McKellen report, that a person was to be appointed. When is that person going to be appointed? Because it was to do a root and branch. If you read that report, it was everything that everybody is looking for. And the reality is, last Friday, for the first time in 30 years, a mill ran out of timber in this country. And they are now looking, blowing in Tallinn, and they are now looking at bringing timber in from Germany, and we haven't grown. And because there's a beetle problem in Germany, they have to debark it, and they're bringing it in. And the problem is that if they start bringing in timber from Germany and do deals with them, there will be people left here high and dry. There's a major problem in the industry. Yes, what Pippa has done will hopefully help in the appeal situation. But in my opinion, we have a grave problem in the department, because the procedure, the way we're doing it, we cannot keep giving it to the inspector, the first application, because they're not qualified. The Habitats Directive has changed all that, because the first thing we have to do within a 20 or 15 kilometre radius of a designated area is be able to either screen it in or screen it out, and we'll be taken to the courts if we're not doing it right.
Okay, I just want to let John in very briefly, John, because we're nearly out of time. Where are you on this?
Yeah, I think we're maybe missing the wood for the trees here a little bit. Forestry is, we're treating forestry, the Quilcha model, which is kind of like the Bord na Mona model, where you take, you know, what should be rich biodiversity and you turn it into an industrial quarry, right? That's how we've approached timber production rather than forestry management in this country. Now, anybody who's walked through a native deciduous forest will know that it's a fabulous amenity resource, and it's also a tremendous carbon sink, a bit like a bog that hasn't been destroyed, right? These are wonderful things, and in the modern era of climate change and biodiversity, these are the things we should be protecting and preserving. We need to look at Caolte and realise that it's going in the wrong direction. And I, just on a couple of Pippa's points, very briefly, one thing I notice is that most of the appeals, that this, the process that Pippa's involved with appears to be shutting down the public's ability to appeal against forestry industry decisions. I gather that most appeals are actually upheld. That suggests the problem isn't with people appealing, it's the problem is with defective applications in the first place. And the second thing, a stat on that is, I believe that 1% of decisions were appealed in 2019. And I think this has been presented by the forestry industry as, oh, quick, help us, shut down all the complainers or we're going to be having to buy stuff from Germany.
Is it not the case, though, John, that something like 50% of all the appeals are coming from a single environmental campaigner?
Sure, yeah. Now, the question, though, probably, Katie, a more important question is, how many of those appeals by that one campaigner are successful, right? So shutting down, I mean, you know, this is like putting out a fire by removing the battery from your fire alarm, right? I think if there's a problem with our planning process, you do not fix that problem by making it harder for people to appeal. And this is in rural Ireland as well, by the way. There are people
I'm going to have to cut across you, John, because we are out of time. Pippa?
I'm just, you know, look, the bill will help. The department has made changes to the licensing issuing process. In fact, most appeals are unsuccessful.
Will there be someone announced shortly on the McKellen report?
The McKellen report, that's a programme for government commitment, and I'll certainly be looking into it very shortly.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there. I want to thank my panel for coming into us tonight. I want to thank all of you out there for listening. I just have time for a couple of headlines from The Examiner. It's one, Elaine is writing that we can save Christmas. That's from Tony Houlihan's press conference this evening. And no penalties if climate bill targets are not met is also with an Elaine Loughlin byline. The programme was produced by Brian Lally. Research was by Andrew Fleming. The broadcast coordinator was Elaine Conlon, and Mark McGrath was on sound. And now it's over a little bit late to Cathal Murray on Late Date.